Across the street, on the cement path between the Carver's front door and the sidewalk, Cynthia has seen Cammy go into the Weiler house. Her eyes widen. Before she can say anything, Steve nudges her sharply. She looks at him and sees he's got a finger to his lips. In his other hand, he's got a knife from the Carver's kitchen rack. "Come on," he murmurs. "You're not going to use that, are you?" "I hope I don't have to," he says. "Are you coming?" As they step off the curb and into Toc's version of the Old West, a confusion of shrieks and shouts commences from inside the Weiler house. "Get out of him," Cynthia hears. Something like that anyway, then more stuff she can't even begin to decipher. Most or all of it seems to be coming from the Weiler woman, although she hears a scream from Cammy Reed. "Put it down, is that what she's screaming?" And a hoarse cry that likely comes from Marinville. Then two whip-cracking rifle shots and a scream of either agony or extreme horror. Cynthia can't tell which, isn't sure she wants to know. Nevertheless, by the time she and Steve reach the far side of Desperation's Main Street, both of them are running. Seth's place, Seth's time. Now. It all comes down to now. He turns away from the shelf with the Play School phone on it. Built into the other side of the passage's wall is a small control panel, very similar to the ones built into the nav pits of the power wagons. Jutting from it is a row of seven switches, each in the position marked on. Above each, a small green telltale glows. This panel wasn't here when Seth reached the end of the passage. Only the pictures of his two families, the picture of Mr. Symes, and the telephone. But this is Seth's place, Seth's time. He can add pretty much whatever he wants to add, whenever he wants to do it. Seth reaches toward the panel with a hand that trembles slightly. In the movies and on TV, the characters never seem afraid. And when Paul Cartwright has to act to save the Ponderosa, he always knows just what to do. Lucas McCain, Rowdy Yates, and Sheriff Streeter are never unsure of themselves. But Seth is. The end of the game is now, and he's terrified of making an irrevocable mistake. For now, he still knows what's going on upstairs. This is how he thinks of Toc's world now, as upstairs. But if he turns these switches... There's no time to reconsider, though. Audrey is in the bathroom. Audrey is rushing for the little boy sitting on the toilet with his underpants dangling from one grimy ankle. The little boy who is, for the time being at least, just a wax dummy with lungs that breathe and a heart that beats. A human machine deserted by both its ghosts. She kneels before him and sweeps him into her arms. She begins to cover his face with kisses, unmindful of anything else, the room, the circumstances. Marinville standing behind her in the doorway. And now Seth senses the red swarm that is Toc flashing across the kitchen. And it has to be now, yes, has to be. His hand reaches the panel and he begins snapping the switches down. The green telltales above them wink out. Red telltales below them wink on. With each flicked switch, his knowledge of what's going on upstairs dims out more. He is not turning off the senses of the wax dummy his aunt is now covering with kisses. He's not sure he could do that if he wanted to, but he can block them off, and he is. Finally, there's nothing left but his mind. It will have to be enough. With his hand pressing down on the switches he has just turned, so they cannot fly back up, Seth reaches out to Aunt Audrey, praying he can still find her in all this dark. The Weiler House, regulator time. At the instant Audrey sweeps the boy off the toilet and into her arms, something blasts past Johnny Marinville, simultaneously as hot as a fever and as cold as frog jelly. His head fills with a swirl of garish red light that makes him think of barroom neon and country music. When it clears, his ability to see everything and sequence even overlapping events has been restored. It's as if the thing that passed him administered some sort of electroshock. That and a sickly flush across his thoughts that feels like slime. As Audrey rises with Seth in her arms, the underoos slip off his foot and he is entirely naked now. Johnny sees that swirl of avid light swing around the boy's head. Then it settles, coating his cheeks, his ears, his sweaty hair. It crams into his open, glazed eyes and lights his teeth scarlet. "No!" Audrey shrieks. "Get out of him! Get out, you bastard!" She leaps for the bathroom door with the boy in her arms. Seth's head seems to be burning. Johnny reaches out. For her, for Seth, both. He doesn't know, and it doesn't matter, because she bursts past him into the filthy kitchen, shrieking and clawing at the dancing swarm of light around Seth's head. Her hand slides uselessly through the red stuff. As she and the boy pass him, Johnny's head is filled with a horrible, machine-like buzzing sound. He screams, clapping his hands to his ears. It is only for a moment as Audrey bolts by, but it is a moment which seems all but eternal just the same. How can there be any boy left under that sound, he wonders. How in God's name can there be anything left under that sound? Let him go! Let him go, cocksucker! Let him go! Then the kitchen doorway is no longer empty. Cammy Reed is standing there with a .30-06 in her hands. Tox place. Tox time. When it reaches Seth and finds all its usual ways in blocked, its rather indulgent respect for the boy's abilities breaks down for the first time since it sensed Seth's extraordinary mind passing by and called out to that mind with all of its strength. What replaces the indulgence first is realization. Anger follows on its wake. It has been wrong, it seems. Seth has known all along that Tack can re-enter, even during evacuation. Has known and has successfully hidden that knowledge, the way a clever gambler will hide an extra ace up his sleeve. In the end, though, not even that matters. It will get in anyway. There is no way the boy can keep it out. There will be no siege here. Seth Garin is his home now. As the woman carries Seth's body past the writer and into the kitchen, Tak assaults the boy's eyes, the ports of entry closest to that wonderful brain. It knows a moment of utterly uncharacteristic panic when at first nothing happens. It is like pushing against a brick wall. Then the bricks begin to soften and give way. Triumph flashes up in its cold mind. Soon, another moment. Two at most. Seth's place, Seth's time. Under his hand, two of the switches are moving up. Even when he redoubles his efforts to hold them down, he can feel them straining under his hand like something alive. The telltales are still red, but not for much longer. Tak is right about one thing. However the two of them may stack up in the matter of wits, Seth is no longer a match for Tak's raw strength. Once, maybe, at the beginning, no more. Still, if he is right, that may not matter. If he is right, and if he is lucky. He glances toward the play school phone, what Aunt Audrey calls the Tak phone, longingly for a moment, but of course he doesn't need a telephone, not really. It was always just a symbol, something concrete to help the telepathy flow more easily between them, as the switches and telltales are simply tools to help him concentrate his will. And telepathy isn't Seth's concern here, anyway. Under his hand, the switches move stubbornly upward, driven by Tak's primitive will. For a moment, the red telltales beneath them flicker out, and the green ones above them flicker on. Seth feels a terrible, machine-like buzzing trying to overwhelm his thoughts. For a moment, his inner vision is blurred by swirling crimson light in which embers flick and stutter. Seth pushes the switches down with all his strength. The green lights go off, the red ones come back on. for the moment anyway. The time is now. There is only one down card left in the game. And now Seth Garin turns it up. The Wyler House, Johnny's time. In a way, it is like being caught in another barrage from the regulators, only this time what Johnny feels cutting past him are thoughts instead of bullets. But weren't they always thoughts, really? The first one goes to Cammie Reed, standing in the kitchen doorway with the gun in her hands. Now! Do it now! The second goes to Audrey Wyler, who recoils as if slapped, and suddenly stops clawing at the spectral red miasma around Seth's head. Now, Aunt Audrey, the time is now! And the last one, a terrible, inhuman roar that fills Johnny's head and wipes out everything else.
No, you little bastard, no, you can't!
No, Johnny thinks, he can't. He never could. Then he raises his eyes to Cammie Reed's face. Her eyes bulge from their sockets. Her lips are stretched in a dry and terrible grin. But she can. Tok's place. Tok's time. It has perhaps 3 seconds while the woman with the gun calls out to realize it has been outplayed. A few seconds of incredulity in which to wonder how that could happen. After all the millennia it has spent trapped in the dark, thinking and planning. Then, even as it begins to realize that Seth isn't really inside the body it has been trying to re-enter, the woman in the doorway opens fire. The Wyler House, Johnny's time. Cammie is no longer sure that she is acting of her own free will, but it doesn't matter. If her will was free, this is still what she would do. The Wyler woman is holding the monstrous brat curled naked in her arms, like an oversized baby, its shanks painted with shit instead of blood and afterbirth, holding it like a shield. Cammie could almost laugh at the idea.
Put it down, Cammie screams.
But instead of putting Seth down, Audrey lifts him higher against her breast. Still grinning her dry, vicious grin, her eyes appearing to start out of their sockets, Johnny will tell himself later that it was an optical illusion. Surely it was. Cammie centers the rifle on the child.
No, Cammie, don't!
Johnny cries. And then she fires. The first shot takes 8-year-old Seth Garin, who is still shivering helplessly with bowel cramps, in the temple, and blows the top of his head off, spattering his aunt's weirdly serene face with blood, hair, and bits of scalp. The slug drives all the way through his brain and exits the far side of his skull, where it enters Audrey's left breast. By then, however, it is too spent to do any further serious damage. It's the second shot that does that, catching her in the throat as she staggers back under the force of the first one. She hits the overloaded kitchen table. Piled dishes fall off and shatter on the floor. She turns to Johnny, the bloody child still in her arms, and Johnny sees an astonishing thing. She looks happy. Cammie screams as Audrey goes down, perhaps in triumph, perhaps in horror at what she has done. Audrey somehow keeps her grip on Seth even as she dies, and as she falls, the uneasy red thing rises from the remains of Seth's face like a caul. It swirls in the air above the filthy linoleum, bright scarlet bits orbiting each other like electrons. Johnny and Cammie Reed face each other through this redness, for he doesn't know how long they are frozen, it seems, until someone screams,
"Oh, shit!" Oh, shit, why'd you do that, you numb bitch?
Johnny sees Steve and Cynthia come forward through the darkened living room until they're standing just behind Cammie. Cynthia springs forward, grabs Cammie by the arm, and shakes her.
Bitch! Stupid murdering cunt! What did you think? This would bring your kid back? Didn't you ever go to fucking school?
Cammie seems not to hear. She is looking at the spinning red thing with wide, unblinking eyes, as if hypnotized. And it is looking back at her. Johnny doesn't know how he can know this, but he does. And suddenly it launches itself at her like a comet. He had asked Audrey if Tak could jump to someone else. She had said no. She was sure it couldn't. But what if she'd been wrong? What if Tak had fooled her? Look out! He shouts at Cynthia. Get back from her! Miss Two-Tone only stares at him, uncomprehending from over Cammy's shoulder. Steve doesn't look as if he understands either, but he reacts to the panic in Johnny's voice and yanks Cynthia back. The swirling red specks divide in two. For a moment, Tak's exterior form looks to Johnny like the sort of fork they used to toast marshmallows on. Only the tines of this fork plunge themselves directly into Cammy Reed's bulging eyes. They glow a brilliant red, swell even further outward, then explode from their sockets. The grin on Cammy's face stretches so wide that her lips split open and begin to stream blood down her chin. The eyeless thing staggers forward, dropping the empty rifle and holding its hands out, clutching blindly at the air. Johnny has never seen anything in his life so simultaneously weak and predatory.
Tak!
It proclaims in a guttural voice nothing like Cammy's.
Takawan! Takala! Mi hemanto!
There is a pause. Then, in a grinding, inhuman voice, Johnny knows he will hear in nightmares until the end of his life, the eyeless thing says,
I know you all. I'll find you all. I'll hunt you down. Tak, me him and to.
Its skull begins to swell outward then. What remains of Cammy's head begins to look like a monster mushroom cap. Johnny hears a tearing sound, like ripping paper, and realizes it's the scant flesh over her skull pulling apart. The clotted sockets of her eyes stretch out long, turning into slits. The swelling skull pulls her nose up into a snout with long, lozenge-shaped nostrils. So, Johnny thinks, Audrey was right. Only Seth was able to contain it. Seth, or someone like Seth. Someone very special because, as if to finish this thought in the most spectacular fashion imaginable, Cammy Reed's head explodes. Hot fragments, some still pulsing with life, pelt Johnny's face. Screaming, revolted, Johnny wipes at the stuff, using his thumbs to try and clear his eyes. Faintly, he can hear Steve and Cynthia also screaming. Then blinding light fills up the room, as sudden and shocking as an unexpected slap. Johnny thinks at first it's an explosion of some sort, the end for all of them. But as his eyes begin to adjust, he sees it's not an explosion but daylight, the strong, hazy light of a summer afternoon. Thunder rumbles off in the east, a throaty sound with no real threat in it. The storm is over. It has lit up the Hobart place, that much he is sure of, because he can smell the smoke, then moved on to play hob with someone else's life. There's another sound, though, the one they waited for so eagerly and in vain earlier, the tangled wail of sirens, police, fire engines, ambulances, maybe the National Guard for all Johnny knows, or cares. The sound of sirens doesn't interest him much at this point. The storm is over. Johnny thinks that regulator time is over, too. He sits down heavily in one of the kitchen chairs and looks at the bodies of Audrey and Seth. Her arms are still around him, and his, poor, thin, wasted arms, unscratched from a single game of tag or follow the leader with other boys his own age, are around her neck. Johnny wipes blood and bone and lumps of brain from his cheeks with his slick palms and begins to cry. From Audrey Wyler's journal, October 31st, 1995. Journal again. Never thought I'd resume. Probably never will on a full-time basis. But it can be so comforting. Seth came to me this morning and managed to ask, with a combination of words and grunts, if he could go out trick-or-treating, like the other kids in the neighborhood. There was no sign of talk, and when he is just Seth, I find him all but impossible to refuse. It isn't hard for me to remember that Seth's not the one responsible for everything that's happened. It's quite easy, in fact. That's what makes it all so horrible. It seals off all my exits. I told him okay. I'd take him trick-or-treating. It would be fun. I said I could probably put together a little cowboy outfit for him, if he'd like that. But if he wanted to go as a moto cop, we'd have to go out to Payless and buy a store outfit. He was shaking his head before I'd even finished. Big back-and-forth shakes. He didn't want to go as a cowboy, and not as a moto cop either. He might be getting tired of cowboys and police from the future, I think. I wonder if the other one knows. Anyway, I asked him what he did want to dress as. He waved one arm and jumped around the room. He was pretending to be in a sword fight. A pirate? I asked, and his whole face lit up in his sweet Seth smile. Pirate, he said, and then tried harder and said it right. Pirate. So I found an old silk kerchief to tie over his head and gave him a clip-on gold hoop to put in his ear and unearthed an old pair of Herb's PJs for pantaloons. With elastic bands on the bottoms, they belled out just right. A mascara beard, an eyeliner scar, and an old toy sword made him look quite fierce. And when I took him out around 4 o'clock to do our block of Poplar Street and 2 blocks of Hyacinth, he looked no different than all the other goblins and witches and Barneys and pirates. When we got back, he spread out all his candy on the living room floor and gloated over it as if it really were a pirate's treasure. Then he hugged me and kissed my neck. So happy. Fuck you, Doc. Fuck you. Fuck you, and I hope you die. March 16th, 1996. This last week, Doc in charge almost completely. Dishes everywhere, glasses filmed with chocolate milk, the house a mess. Ants, Christ, ants in March. It looks like a house where lunatics live, and is that so wrong? My nipples are on fire from all the pinching it's made me do. It's angry because it can't do what it wants with its version of Cassandra Styles. I feed it. I buy the new Moto Cop's toys it wants. But for that other purpose, I am useless. As much of the week as I could, I spent with Jan. Then, today, while I was trying to clean up a little, I broke my mother's favorite plate, the one with the Courier and Ives sledding scene on it. Talk had nothing to do with it. I picked it up off the mantel shelf in the dining room where I keep it displayed, wanting to give it a little dusting, and it simply slipped through my stupid fingers and broke on the floor. All at once, it was like it was my life I was looking at instead of an old china plate smashed to shit on the dining room floor. Cheap symbolism, Peter Jackson from across the street would probably say. Probably true. But when we are in pain, we are rarely creative. I began picking up the pieces, sobbing while I did it. I didn't even hear the TV go off. Tark and Seth had been having a Moto Cops 2200 festival most of the day. But when a shadow fell over me and I looked up, there he was. At first I thought it was Tark. Seth has been mostly gone this last week or lying low. But then I saw the eyes. They both use the same set. You'd think they wouldn't change, couldn't, but they do. Seth's are lighter and have a range of emotion Tark can never manage. I broke my mother's plate, I said. It was all I had of her, and it slipped through my fingers. It came on worse than ever. I put my arms around my knees and just cried. Seth came closer, put his own arms around my neck, and hugged me. Something wonderful happened when he did. I can't explain it exactly, but it was so good that it made visiting with Jan seem ordinary in comparison. Tak can make me feel bad, terrible, in fact, as if the whole world is nothing but a ball of mud squirming with worms just like me. It likes it when I feel bad. It licks those bad feelings right off my skin, I know it. This was the opposite, and more. My tears stopped, and my feelings of sadness were replaced by such a sense of joy and, not ecstasy exactly, but serenity and optimism all mixed together, as if everything couldn't help but turn out all right. As if everything was already all right, and I just couldn't see that in my ordinary state of mind. I was filled up, the way good food fills you up when you're hungry. I was renewed. Seth did that. He did it when he hugged me. And he did it, I think, I know, in exactly the same way talk makes me feel the bad things, which it can only do because it has Seth's power to draw on. And I think that when Seth took away my sadness this afternoon, he was able to do it because he had Tak's power to draw on. And I don't think Tak knew he was doing that, or he would have made him stop. Here's something that's never occurred to me until today. Seth may be stronger than Tak knows. Much stronger. Johnny didn't know how long he sat in the kitchen chair, head down, tears pouring out of his eyes, before he felt a soft hand on the back of his neck and looked up to see the girl from the market. Johnny looked through the living room picture window and saw Steve standing on the dispirited grass of the Weiler lawn, looking down the street. Some of the sirens had died, others were still whooping like Indians as they approached. "You okay, Mr. Marinville?"
"Yeah."
He tried to say more, but what came out instead was a half-sob. He wiped his nose with the back of his hand and then tried to smile.
"Cynthia, isn't it?"
"Cynthia, yep.
And I'm Johnny. Just Johnny."
"Kay." She was looking down at the entwined bodies. Audrey's head was thrown back, her eyes closed, her face still and serene, and the boy looked like an infant in his fragile nakedness.
"Look at them," Cynthia said softly, his arms around her neck like that. "He must have loved her such a lot."
"He killed her," Johnny said flatly. "He called Cammy in on her."
"Called her in? What do you mean, called her in?"
"He called her in on both of them, in fact. I heard him do it." He tapped his temple.
"You're saying Seth told Cammy to kill them?"
He nodded.
"The other one, maybe. You might have heard him, it."
Johnny shook his head. "Nope, it was Seth, not Tak. I recognized his voice." He paused, looked at the dead child, then back at Cynthia. "Even in my head, he was a mouth breather."
The houses had returned to what they really were, Steve saw, but that didn't mean normal. They had clearly taken one hell of a pasting. The Hobart place was no longer burning, there was that much. The downpour had tamped the fire to a sullen fume. The old veterinarian's bungalow was more fully involved, with flames leaping from the windows and black charry patches spreading along the eaves and bubbling the paint. Between them, the house of Peter and Mary Jackson was a tumbled, shot-up ruin. There were two fire engines on the street and more coming. Already hoses lay tangled on the lawns. There were police cars, too. Three were parked in front of Intrajan's place, where the newsboy's body, and Hannibal's, lay under plastic now puddled from the downpour. The cruiser's red lights swung and flashed. Two more cruisers were parked at the top of the street, blocking the Bear Street end off entirely.
"Won't do any good if they come back," Steve thought. "If the regulators come back, boys, they'll blow your little roadblock right over the nearest ice cap."
Except they wouldn't be back. That was what the sunlight meant.
what the retreating thunder meant. It had all really happened. Steve had only to look at the burning and shot up houses to know that. But it had happened in some weird fistula of time that these cops would never know about or want to know about. He looked down at his watch and wasn't surprised to see it running again. 5:18, it said, and he guessed that was as close to the real time as his Timex was ever going to get. He looked back down the street at the cops. Some of them had their guns out, some did not. Not one of them looked clear on how he or she was supposed to behave. They were looking at a shooting gallery, after all, and probably no one on the surrounding blocks had even heard any shots, thunder maybe, but gunshots that sounded like mortar shells. They saw him on the lawn, and one of them beckoned. At the same time, two others were gesturing for him to go back into the Weiler house. They looked like a pretty mind-fucked posse, all in all. You'll be a while figuring it out, Steve thought, but you'll get something you can live with in the end. You guys always do. Whether it's a crashed flying saucer in Roswell, New Mexico, an empty ship in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, or a suburban Ohio street turned into a fire corridor, you always come up with something. You're never going to catch anyone, and you won't believe a single word any of us say, but in the end, you'll find something that will allow you to reholster your guns and sleep at night. And you know what I say to that? No problem. That's what. No fucking problem. One of the cops was now pointing a bullhorn at him.
Are you a hostage?
Mr. Bullhorn boomed.
Are you a hostage taker?
Steve grinned, cupped his hands around his mouth, and called back.
I'm a Libra, friendly with strangers, loves good conversation.
A pause. Mr. Bullhorn conferred with several of his mates. Then he turned back to Steve and raised the bullhorn again.
Will you repeat?
Steve didn't. Across from where he stood, Dave Reed and Susie Geller came out of the Carver house, arms around each other. They stepped carefully over the dead girl on the stoop and walked down to the sidewalk. Behind them came Brad and Belinda Josephson, shepherding the Carver children and shielding them from the sight of their father, still lying dead in his driveway. Behind them came Tom Billingsley. He had what looked like a linen tablecloth in his gnarled hands. This he shook out over the dead girl's corpse, taking no notice of the man down the block who was trying to hail him with the bullhorn. Where's my mom? Dave called to Steve. His eyes looked simultaneously wild and exhausted. Have you seen my mom? And Steve Ames, whose life's motto had been nullo impedimentum, hadn't the slightest idea of what to say. Johnny got into the living room, walking on tiptoe, and stepping over as much of the mess Cammy had left as he could. Once past that obstacle, he started for the door. He had brought his tears under control for the time being. He looked at the clock standing on the mantel. It said 5:21, and that felt about right. Cynthia caught his arm. He turned to her, feeling a bit impatient. Through the picture window, he could see the other Poplar Street survivors clustering in the middle of the street. So far, they were ignoring the hails from the cops, who didn't seem to know if they should come up or hold their positions. And Johnny wanted to join his neighbors before they made up their minds one way or the other. Is it gone? She asked. Tack, that red thing, whatever it was, is it gone? He looked back into the kitchen. It hurt him almost physically to do this, but he managed. There was plenty of red in there, the walls were painted with it, the ceiling too, but no sign of the glowing, embery thing that had tried to find a safe harbor in Cammy Reed's head after its primary host had been killed. Did it die when she did? The girl was looking at him with pleading eyes. Say it did, okay? Make me feel good and say it did. It must have, Johnny said. If it hadn't, I imagine it would be trying one of us on for size right now. She let out air in a gusty rush. Yeah, that makes sense. So it did. But Johnny didn't believe it, not for a second. I know you all, it had said. I'll hunt you down. Maybe it would. And maybe it would have a more strenuous fight on its hands than it had bargained for. But there was no sense worrying about it now.
Takawan! Takala! Mihem ento!
What is it? Cynthia asked. What's wrong? You're shivering. Johnny smiled. I guess a goose just walked over my grave. He took her hand off his arm and folded his fingers through hers. Come on, let's go out and see how everyone's doing. They were almost to the street and the others when Cynthia came to a stop. Oh my God, she said in a soft, strengthless voice. Oh my God, look. Johnny turned. The storm had moved on, but there was one isolated thunderhead just west of them. It hung over downtown Columbus, connected to Ohio by a gauzy umbilicus of rain, and made the shape of a gigantic cowboy galloping on a storm-colored stallion.
A ghost rider, Brad said. Holy shit! A goddamn ghost rider in the sky. Do you see it, Bee?
Cynthia moaned through the hand she'd pressed to her mouth, looked up at the cloud shape, head shaking from side to side in a useless gesture of negation. The others were looking now as well. Not the firemen and not the cops, who would break out of their indecision soon and come on up here to join the party, but the folk who had survived the regulators. Steve took Cynthia by her thin arms and drew her gently away from Johnny.
Stop it, he said. It can't hurt us. It's just a cloud. It's going away already, see?
It was true. The flank of the sky horse was tearing open in some places, melting in others, letting the sun through in long, hazy rays. It was just a summer afternoon again. Steve glanced down the street and saw a police car rolling, very slowly, up the hill toward them, running over the tangled fire hoses. He looked back at Johnny.
Yo.
Yo what? Did he commit suicide, that kid?
I don't know what else you'd call it, Johnny said, but he supposed he knew why the hippie had asked. It hadn't felt like suicide somehow.
The police cruiser stopped. The man who got out was wearing a khaki uniform which came equipped with roughly 1 ton of gold braid. His eyes, a very sharp blue, were almost lost in a webwork of wrinkles. His gun, a big one, was in his hand. He looked like someone Johnny had seen before, and after a moment it came to him, Ben Johnson, who had played saintly ranchers and satanic outlaws with equal grace and ability.
Someone want to tell me what in the name of Jesus Christ the Redeemer went on here?
No one replied, and after a moment, Johnny Merrinville realized they were all looking at him. He stepped forward and said,
Outlaws. I beg your pardon.
Outlaws. Regulators. Renegades from the wastes.
My friend, if you see anything funny about this,
I don't, sir. No, indeed. And it's going to get even further from funny when you look in there. Johnny pointed toward the Weiler house, and as he did, suddenly thought of his guitar. Oh, how nice it would be to sit on his porch step and strum and sing the ballad of Jesse James in the key of D. That was the one that went, Oh, Jesse had a wife to mourn for his life. 3 children, they were brave. He supposed his old Gibson might have a hole in it. His house looked pretty well trashed, but, on the other hand, it might be perfectly fine. Some of them had come through okay, after all. Johnny started in that direction, already hearing the song as it would come from under his hand and out of his throat. For you slept in Jesse's bed, and you ate of Jesse's bread, and you have laid Jesse James down in his grave.
Hey, the cop called. Just where in the hell do you think you're going?
To sing a song about the good guys and the bad guys, Johnny said.
He put his head down and felt the hazy heat of the summer sun on his neck and kept walking. Letter from Mrs. Patricia Allen to Catherine Ann Goodlow of Montpelier, Vermont. June 19, 1986. Dear Kathy, this is the most beautiful place in the whole world. I'm convinced of it. The honeymoon has been the sweetest 9 days of my whole life. And the nights, I feel like a kid living in a candy factory. Enough of that, though. I didn't write to tell you about the new Mrs. Allen's sex life, or even about the beauty of the Catskills. I'm writing because Tom's downstairs shooting pool, and I know how much you love a spooky story. If that was all, though, I probably would have just waited until Tom and I got back, and then told you my tale face to face. But I might actually have a souvenir of this particular tale from the beyond, and that has caused me to pick up my pen on this beautiful evening. The Mohonk Mountain House was opened in 1869, and it has its share of ghost stories. But the one I'm writing you about is something of an oddity. Not a single turn-of-the-century lady or 1929 stock market crash suicide in it. These two ghosts, a mother and son, have only been actively haunting for the last 4 years or so, as far as I've been able to find out, and I've been able to find out a fair amount. The staff is very helpful to visitors who want to do a little ghost hunting on the side. Adds to the ambience, I suppose. The ghosts of the mother and son were first spotted by guests in the summer of 1982. They were always seen around a particular gazebo, which is located at the top of a hill and looks down toward a rock wall, which is pretty much buried in honeysuckle and wild roses. They aren't spooky ghosts at all, so don't get your hopes up. The woman is described as being in her 30s, pretty, long legs, chestnut-brown hair. Her son is small and very slim, probably about 6. His face has been described as intelligent, lively, and even beautiful. And although they've been seen by a variety of people over a course of years, they are always described as wearing the same clothes. White running shorts, sleeveless blouse, and low-top sneakers for her, basketball shorts and a tank top, and cowboy boots for him. All sorts of little souvenirs have been found at that particular gazebo. You know the weirdest? Half-eaten plates of Franco-American spaghetti. There have been other things as well. Toys, a coloring book, a small silver makeup case. My friend at the concierge's desk, Adrian, smiles and nods when you suggest it's all a put-up job, that ghosts don't leave actual physical objects behind. Not ordinary ones, he says, but maybe they aren't ordinary ghosts. They might be real people who are living on a slightly different plane than ours. There is something very special about that meadow, something hushed and almost holy. I didn't see the ghosts, but there is definitely a feeling of presence there. And when I went into the gazebo itself, to sit and rest up a little for the walk back, I found this little souvenir I'm enclosing. It is pretty clearly what the kids call an action figure, but I've been teaching kindergarten for 3 years now, and I thought I knew them all. I'll show it to my incoming class of 5-year-olds next fall, but I'm betting that A, all of them will want her, and B, none of them will know her. When I think about what Adrian said, it gives me the shivers. What if Little Miss Pink Jumpsuit came from a kiddie show in an alternate universe?
Or from a show in our own world's future. Okay, okay, so a strong wind has come up outside and the lights are flickering. Put it down to that, if you want. Okay, girl, that's my creepy story for the night. I'm gonna stick Miss Pink and this letter in a little padded mailer from the gift shop. Then see if I can persuade Tom it's time to stop shooting bumper pool and come to bed. Frankly, I'm not expecting it to be a problem. I love being married, and I love this place, ghosts and all. Still your fan, Tom.